Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I'm just really glad to have you there today because the subject for today is one that I just, when I first heard about what was now going to be done to our children, I didn't know what in the world to do. This was 2 days ago, and I got an email from my guest, Michael Cornwall, who many of you know from this radio show or from other places. He's a psychotherapist. He's a good man. He's a humanitarian. He's a thoughtful human being. He comes from lived experience and went on to get a PhD in psychology, and he has worked on the development of alternative programs for people who are in alternative realities. And he is also a trainer at Esalen Institute. Michael, are you there? Michael?
Yes, Peter, I'm here.
Oh, gosh. Gave me a scare there for a minute, because I want you to do a lot of talking today. Let me just introduce the show a little more before we talk about this new horror. This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and if you're listening on May 15th, 2019, you're listening live on www.prn.fm. You're listening live, so you can call in. And you can call in on 888-874-4888. You can find out all this information and, find out a lot more about me, but also get information about the show and everything I'm mentioning in my intro at Breggin.com, Breggin.com. We have a featured daily breaking news, which is tremendous. It has a ton of positive information about what really helps people, as well as this kind of miserable information about how we harm our children. And there's a PRN app that you can use and listen to it from anywhere. And to keep track of my work with the frequent alerts that are free on Breggin.com. So going through that real quick. Oh, and also don't forget that you have your own dedicated email to get in touch with me. That's BregginLive@Hotmail.com. And you can email me there, and I do read the emails, and occasionally I can find one that I can answer, and it definitely shapes how I'm running the show. So, Michael Cornwall, what are they up to now? You tell them.
Well, Peter, it's to me, it's both amazing and horrifying that just a couple of weeks ago, the FDA, which is supposed to be the watchdog agency to protect all of us from harm, from consumer harm and from products that hurt us, the FDA approved the marketing of a new device to be used for, I would say, on children age 7 to 12 who've been diagnosed with what I'd say so-called ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And this new device is called a Monarch ETNS. It's a device about the size of your cell phone with a wire that comes from the device to a patch, an adhesive patch with a sensor in it that's put on the child's forehead above their eyebrows while they sleep at night. And what happens is an electrical current is transmitted into the child's brain all night long, supposedly to reduce their symptoms of so-called ADHD. What's so amazing about this is the actual language in the FDA press release, which folks can Google it and see for themselves, it says, this device, quote, sends therapeutic signals to the parts of the brain associated with ADHD. Therapeutic signals? The parts of the brain associated with ADHD? I know, Peter, you're going to have a lot to say about the brain and how that is a bogus pseudoscience claim they're making. But what's even worse are the openly stated side effects that this thing does to children as they sleep. It causes headache and fatigue, teeth clenching, appetite increase, drowsiness, and trouble sleeping, all in the name of relieving their so-called ADHD. And the information goes on to say the exact mechanisms of this device is not yet known. So they also say, but no serious adverse effects associated with its use have been found. Those side effects look like very adverse events to me. So just imagine a parent concerned about their child. They're getting a lot of pressure from the teacher at school to have their child evaluated for ADHD. They're being concerned that, you know, their child may be put in a separate classroom or something. So they go to the physician, and the physician prescribes this. And that means, you know, you just imagine a seven-year-old little girl or boy every night having this thing stuck on their forehead. And it says, the experience of having this on your forehead is like a tingling sensation. So all night long, there's this distracting electricity. You know, that's what electricity feels like when it's going into you. Anyway, it's just, to me, such a tragic development that the FDA would market this. And it's also amazing that the so-called science behind this was from the research was only 62 children. There were half of them got this brain device at night, and half of them got some kind of placebo. So to put something on the market like this, I think it should never be put on under any circumstances, but to have a claim that this is a legitimate medical device after only 62 children were in the study.
Yeah, well, and keep in mind, that means about 30 kids got the device.
Yeah, and so only 30 kids got the device. I mean, usually even the god-awful trials they've done on some of these medications that you're the expert on, They have hundreds, if not thousands, of kids, as they often twist and turn the results of the medication trials. But for this thing to be put on the market when only 30 kids have experienced it, and also this is another huge thing that just knocked the wind out of me. The results, Peter. The FDA says positive response to the device takes 4 weeks to become evident. So that means every night for 4 weeks, a loving parent in good faith, trusting their doctor, is putting this on their kid's forehead for 4 weeks and not seeing any change. And then, as you and I were talking a little bit before the program, how they measure change on some kind of bogus interpretation of the ADHD diagnosis of severe, moderate, or light ADHD, that's also almost laughable if it wasn't so sad. So you wait for a month to see results, and your child in the meantime suffers these side effects of drowsiness, increased appetite, trouble sleeping, clenching teeth, headache, and fatigue. What do you think?
I just wish you'd do all the talking. This is so horrific. Let's start with the basics. First of all, There is no such thing as ADHD as a disorder. There are kids who don't concentrate well. There are kids who might be a little jumpy. There are kids who don't fit in the mold and pay good attention to the teacher. There are kids who are so anxious they can't participate in school. There are kids who are being abused at home, who may be having problems at school, and the abuse may be coming from a sibling, and on and on. There's no disease of ADHD. There are reasons why kids behave the way they do. There are reasons that can be understood and often easily corrected in a family therapy setting. Easily, once you figure out with the family what's going on, it might be the teacher, the kid hates his teacher, the teacher hates the kid. I mean, I had teachers who hated me when I was a kid, and I had teachers I loved, and I had teachers who loved me. They're people. So you're starting out with a concept whose only purpose is to distract you from the child in order to give the child's brain, as if there's no child attached, a drug, and now a machine, jolt of electricity. The vast majority of these children who get labeled ADHD in a practice like mine, which comes from good families, basically, and not from, you know, decimated families like we might get in other parts of the country or the world. But most of them, these kids lack discipline because so many modern parents are afraid to discipline their kids. They think it's not right. They don't believe in disciplining their kids. They don't believe that they should say something and a kid should take it seriously. They're not leading their kids and teaching their kids. They think their kids should grow up more or less on their own. They don't even want to monitor their homework or work with them on their homework often because they don't think it's a good thing. So the whole concept that there are these children is bizarre. Then comes the concept that that kids who get this label are helped by drugs. That's one of the pushing points of this. This is being pushed very big, guys. Very big, my friends. That, oh, well, we have 20% of children with ADHD who aren't helped by the drugs. There's no evidence that any of the kids are helped by the drugs. They have been trying to prove that for years. They finally spent millions of dollars giving a bunch of old boys, and they were mostly old boys, the old boys club of ADHD, getting in their ancient ears, a final big project by NIMH that didn't show any improvement over placebo after weeks and weeks and weeks on the drugs. And now we're hearing that the kids need 4 weeks to get to improve, probably, and I'll get this data for you at some point, and we'll have Michael back and we'll talk about it. Probably the studies lasted 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And when they finally got a positive effect, they probably shut the study down before they had to deal with what happens in the next 6 or 8 weeks. Because there are no studies showing that, you know, after 4, 6, or 8 weeks that the drugs are helping these kids. All these things can do is shut down the brain. All they can do is harm the brain, and the child may become more obedient for a while, because when you injure kids, they become more obedient. Injure adults, and they become more obedient. So any way you look at this, it's horrible, and we haven't even yet begun to speak about the moral, psychological impact of telling children they have defective brains, giving them a biological diagnosis when there's nothing biologically wrong with them, and then actually screwing up their brain biologically. But just think of the moral and educational and psychological impact. We have kids here at Cornell, which is in my hometown of Ithaca, who they get special privileges because they get an ADHD diagnosis. They don't take the They can take exams longer, or they may be able to take the exams privately, that is alone, without distraction. I worked with a judge in Pennsylvania at one point. He's retired now. And the law school wanted to give these same advantages to law students and on the law boards, so they could take the law boards, without distraction and have as much time as they wanted to finish it. And he said he'd support this as long as the degree was called the ADHD law degree. Beware, your lawyer may work more slowly and get distracted. I mean, that's how bizarre this gets, that we end up spoiling the whole goal of the educational system, which is to reach a certain level of competence. And then these kids not only feel entitled, they feel defective. So on the one hand, they think they're lucky to have these, some of them, or certainly the ones that take these advantages, they feel lucky. And furthermore, they feel they deserve it and so on. But they're actually learning to be helpless and dependent, to not trust themselves, to believe their brains are defective, to doubt their real abilities. And in many circumstances, by having a child labeled ADHD, the mother gets support for the child from the Social Security system. So that's another motivation. And meanwhile, nobody learns to help the child. The teacher doesn't change her teaching. The parents don't change their way of helping the child learn, teaching to get discipline, self-discipline, teaching the child why one should be motivated to work, things like that. So this is such a mess. There's just too many ends to grab, and I'm going to take a breather and give this back to Michael.
Okay.
I really got flummoxed when Michael sent me this.
I know. Well, I did too when I read that. I've had that awful experience that I'm sure a lot of your listeners have, of feeling the emotional presence of both grief and anger at the same time. Part of that grief for me, Peter, comes from starting in the 1980s. I began working for 28 years in a public mental health system as a full-time therapist. And during that whole time, I was seeing kids and families, teens. And as you know, those public systems is where so much of what psychiatry and big pharma and NAMI cooks up gets operationalized on foster kids and kids, you know, who are living in dire circumstances, and kind of war zones with drugs and gangs and violence. So I spent 28 years in that zone. And the last 12 years, I was actually working in a child and adolescent clinic. So when I see this happening, it just breaks my heart and infuriates me, because what happens, too, with that whole ADHD diagnosis, and in my view, all those diagnoses, they let society and definitely they serve, you know, the drug companies and psychiatry. But back in the early 90s, I put together a survey for the hundreds of workers there in our system to report on the different forms of abuse and neglect and harm being done to the children that they were seeing there in real time. And it came back. It shocked everybody. It was news in the newspaper. It didn't shock me, but the majority of kids, you know, in these public sector, urban, suburban, even settings, are exposed to tremendous trauma at home, in their neighborhoods, at school. So when the whole onus of what a kid may be displaying, who's having a hard time sitting, you know, at 8 in the morning and concentrating, gets labeled ADHD, it lets everyone off the hook, you know, if it's not, you know, what's going on in this kid's life? And this is something you've talked about all the time. Look at what's going on in anyone's life if you want to know why they might be suffering, why they might be acting out. And so to have this now brain device that's hooked up to the kid's head, it's just another way of saying, we're not going to look at anything that's going on in our society, in our economy, in our social justice, in our neighborhoods, in our schools, in our families. We're just going to say, you've got something wrong with your brain. And to that point you were making a minute ago about the demoralizing, soul-killing effect of these diagnoses, just recently, Peter, because I still do see kids and teens in my private practice, a mom came in who was getting pressure from the school to have her kid, you know, put on ADHD drugs, and he was in kindergarten, right? The amazing thing is so much of this medication is being prescribed off-label. As you know, there was a CDC urgent alert came out just 3 or 4 years ago that 10,000 toddlers under the age of 3 were being given ADHD stimulant drugs, which are amphetamines. 10,000 toddlers. So this little boy came in with his mom to see me, and there was all this pressure going on at the school. You got to take him to a psychiatrist. You got to get him put on meds, because even though he's doing well academically, he's doing well. He's keeping up. He fidgets. He doesn't sit still, you know. And I mean, that's kind of the knee-jerk norm, tragically, in the schools who are overwhelmed. The teachers who love their kids, you know, they got 40 kids in the classroom. They're about on the verge of a nervous breakdown. So anyway, the parent took this little boy, you know, kind of doing the due diligence. Well, I just wanted to check it out, to a child psychiatrist at one of the large HMOs here in California, you know, health maintenance organizations. The child psychiatrist sits there listening for 10 minutes to what the mom's telling him about the little boy's having a few problems at school. The little boy's sitting there on the floor, and Peter, the child psychiatrist, leans over, pulls open a drawer in his desk, reaches in, and pulls out a plastic model of a child's brain, holds it up. The little boy's eyes get big. The psychiatrist points to a point on the brain and says, this is where you have a problem with your brain, right here. This is a model of your brain. This is where the problem with your brain is, right here, with the attention problem. But the medication I'm going to give you today will fix that. So that's the nightmare scenario. From that point on, any of us, when we get that kind of diagnosis, there's something wrong with our brain. That sticks, as you know, whether it's bipolar, so-called schizophrenia, or whatever. And so the cost to just the soul of people when they get labeled this way, and I think of those poor 30 kids in this study for a month, what were they told, you know? 20 years old, we're going to, every night your mom's going to put this thing on your forehead because you've got something wrong with your brain. They're going to carry that as a trauma for the rest of their life, right?
I mean, I think forever, and they may not even know it, because they will integrate it into their self-esteem system, right, to try to convince themselves that it's good to know I'm defective, because then I get the medications, or I get the special services and circumstances to help me get good grades. It's just, and again, there is no evidence the drugs work. I mean, look at any of my books. Look at Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. I review this there. Read, you know, my books on my book, The Ritalin Fact Book. The evidence is that they don't work, and that the drugs, they stunt growth, they cause psychosis, obsessive compulsive disorder. And I did manage to print out another one of the publications touting this. And lo and behold, my guess was right. The study only went 4 weeks. Uh-huh. So here you are. You have to wait to the fourth week, because this thing doesn't really work very well or at all. In fact, it's going to do more harm than good. And finally, you build up enough numbers to be able to fake it, that it's an effective treatment. And then you don't go beyond 4 weeks, either because the kids are dropping out and you knew they were gonna, because they it doesn't help very well, or you knew that over further weeks the side effects were just going to get terrible, so you make it a four-week study. Why does the FDA, how evil has it become that it allows a four-week study to expose children to months and years of electrical brain stimulation about which at this moment we only know it causes harm. We don't know how much harm it causes. It's so disgraceful. And the differences they got between the control group was and the, which was probably, I'm gathering, was strapping something similar onto the kids without giving them electricity.
Yeah.
So both groups improved. The degree of rated improvement in the electricalized group was quite small. It looks like it has no clinical significance, but consider the fact that you can't really do a sham study because the doctors who usually are the ones who rate something as positive, we don't have anything in here saying patients, kids thought they were thinking better or clearer, or better, harder, longer. We don't have anything from the parents saying their behavior improved. So we don't know from these handouts we're getting so far what was the rating scale that they're basing the decision on. And most likely it was a doctor-related scale. And the doctor knows who is getting the electricity and who isn't, because at the least the kids getting the electricity are saying, it's tickling me. And at worst, the kids are saying, I got a headache. I feel crappy, I'm tired, or their parents are saying he's tired, he wants Tylenol. So the fact that you can easily tell who is getting treatment and who isn't means that the doctors who are hired by the drug companies know just who, consciously or unconsciously, to rate as improved. And yet they still can't come up with anything except a marginal improvement on some rating scale, which I will eventually find and come back and talk with you about, and at 4 weeks, and you know, even if you decided if you were allowed to do this the way the FDA did, I mean, you shouldn't allow it to get. For that to be enough, those 4 weeks, you should put these kids on, you know, study them over a period of months. But I would say it's all unethical. Yeah. It's all ridiculous. There is no way to pick out the ADHD center and fix it. It's a bunch of bull. I'm so tempted to curse and to rant. So I wanted Michael on. Stabilize.
I'll join you
You want to join in the rant?
Well, it's and of course the whole study and the ratings are based on the phony ADHD diagnosis. So the whole thing is a house of cards.
Yes.
But apparently, this what they think the science is that they're claiming is that this transmits electricity to the branches of the trigeminal nerve, which is a fifth cranial nerve. So basically they're giving electricity. I mean, you're the physician. I mean, the anatomy of that, it's as far as I know, that nerve can be affected, you know, if you put something right on it, on someone's forehead. You know, what kind of human subject would they have to get over to do that? I remember many years ago when I was just doing my quantitative doctoral research, I had to do all through all kinds of hoops around human study protocols and you know, sign-offs and informed consent and everything. I mean, I think there's something real sinister in terms of the progression of these experiments that are passing these human study protocols, don't you, Peter, to be able to say, you know, we want to do this study where we're going to take 60 kids, we'll take 30 of them, and we'll put electricity into their brain. We have no idea what it'll do, but sign off and let us do this. I mean, how does that happen?
By a lot of people either being on the take or knowing they're going to have good jobs with the drug companies or the machine companies after they retire and can start double dipping, from growing up on fake science, getting fake science in the neuroscience books in college. I mean, it just comes from so many different ways. But fundamentally, I think it comes from a hatred of children. I mean, what does it take to, and hating yourself when you were a child on some level? I don't want to diagnose anybody in particular, and obviously I can't do that. But what would drive somebody to grow up and want to make machines and sell machines that, you know, tamper with the human brain? I mean, this idea that it's the trigeminal nerve is ridiculous. It's flooding the front of the brain. It's flooding the frontal lobes. It's on the forehead.
Right.
What's beneath the forehead? The prefrontal cortex, the good old lobotomy area. That lies below the forehead. When that monster Walter Freeman was doing lobotomies, he would stick an ice pick around the eyeball, tap it to knock it through the bone, which up around that forehead, in that particular area, is pretty thin, and he'd swish it around in precisely the area that this electricity is going into, which is the front of the highest centers of the human brain.
Yeah.
That's what it's lying on top of. And you do it enough, and you'll have an electrical lobotomy. May not be gross. It may be partial. But that's what you're going to get, because that's where the electricity is coming through. It's just a disgrace.
Well, I know that you're the leader, as far as I know, in the whole for decades against the abuse and use of ECT, and there was even a huge lawsuit that you were involved in recently where the actual people who make these ECT devices are being held liable. Who's to say that, you know, 4, 5, 10, 15 years from now, the kids who are getting this stuff done to their frontal cortex aren't going to be coming in with, you know, diagnosable brain damage. You know, but by then, these people, you know, these companies will have, and the prescribers and everybody would have made their money and moved on. But, you know, that's potentially what could happen. I mean, there are corollaries between this and ECT and lobotomy, as you're saying, right?
Exactly. It's a matter of degree. So you want a little less lobotomy, but what about a child's brain? What happens in a kiddie brain? It's a fine point, but let me just give a little more detail on what happened with this lawsuit. For years and years, all of the drug company, all of the manufacturers, and this is a manufactured thing too, all the manufacturers of the electroshock machines said that it couldn't cause brain damage or serious mental problems or memory loss, period. That getting 20 convulsions, going into a coma and waking up with symptoms of a severe concussive disorder and literally traumatic brain injury and doing it repeatedly was fine and harmless. And the case against one of the particular manufacturers, Salve, who manufactures the Trimeton. I'm just so frustrated by all this. the Thymatron machine. By the way, you can find all this on my website, or just go to www.123ect.org. So go to www.123 ECT.org. And if that doesn't work well for you, go to .com. So what happened is that this suit against the drug company was brought by California attorney, and he asked me to write a report for the judge, an affidavit as to why the judge should allow the case to go forward, that there was enough evidence for brain damage for a jury to be given the question. Did this cause brain damage? Do you believe Dr. Bregan? The company tried to stop that and said, no, there's no evidence. Don't let Dr. Bregan in, and so on. And the judge responded with a finding that there was enough scientific evidence for brain damage and memory loss and other things from ECT that we could go to trial. And the drug company the shot company immediately settled and then wrote a report to the FDA stating that the Thymotron machine could cause brain damage and serious memory loss, extensive memory loss, God, and warned doctors they better tell patients. That's a big deal, but it took since 1954.
I know.
No, 34, 1934, when the machines were first built and the shocking started. I had a very busy day yesterday, folks, and I had some illness in the family. Nobody that any of you know on the air, and I got tired, and so I'm just not knocking it down as I might usually. And I only just made it to the show, so I was away for a day and a half. So 1939 is when they start. With the shock machine. So we're giving a mini lobotomy to these children, and it's already in the 4 weeks producing signs of damage like fatigue and headache. That's a sign of damage, guys. And you got that in 4 weeks. I bet you got it sooner in some of the kids. And then you stopped so you wouldn't have to see what the real results were going to be of this. If anybody wants to call in, I would be happy to have some guests. I know the way Michael and I are so involved that in this kind of a show, we often do not get callers. But if you want to call in and share the pain, 888-874-4888 to talk about this theme. It's the last week of the month is when I have open date, Mike Friday. That's going to be on May 29th. I do open Mike Friday, and we talk about anything. But I'd love to have you come in and talk. Just give an expression of what you feel, what you think. What do you think this is like for the children? 888-874-4888. Michael, say some stuff.
Yes. Well, I got to thank you. I mean, everybody should, for your fight, you know, on many fronts, but on the ECT, like you said, from 1939 to 2018 or 19, finally, the truth that so many of us knew, they had to admit it, you know, for the shock machine company to you know, do the damage control and go to the FDA and say, well, actually, it does. Now, all you doctors, you're on your own. You know, we all owe you a huge debt for the many battles you've fought. But that one, I know there's a huge movement against shock. But you know, you were the one who went and convinced that judge to allow it and got the ruling. So the thing about children, I remember one of the shows you and I did a while back was when another outrage for kids with ADHD came out. The drug company came up with that time-release chewable orange flavored, like gummy bear Adderall. Remember a couple of years or so ago? It's called Adzenzis. I checked up on that last night. So that's going full steam. You know, just another way of them cashing in on any way they can. So this is a drug of Adderall where, you know, some kids weren't swallowing the pills easily. So the ingenious people designing all this stuff, well, let's put it in a little chewable, orange-flavored, tasty thing like a piece of candy. So, you know, it will increase compliance. That's booming. You know, those prescriptions for that, you know, that you and I talked about on your show one time is happening. And my guess is this device that puts electricity into the kid's brain at night, you know, it'll become widespread use. It's going
to be so widespread. They're pushing it. The biggest child and adolescent psychiatric journals got a positive article on it. The Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I mean, this is an atrocity. This is an little mini lobotomies for little bitty kitties. I mean, it's an atrocity. Let us take a breather and invite Julie, who knows more than she wants to know about shock treatment from Massachusetts. And
Hi. Can you
hello?
Hello, hi, Julie.
Hi. I just worked for a cyber school, and I left my job because of psychiatric labeling. And what I saw there, I saw so much, and I did some research too, that I'm actually going to write an article about this. Probably put it in you know, the families and children section of Mad in America, if they'll take the article. But I'm going to have to write it under a pseudonym, because my current job, if they find the article, I'm canned. Basically, they were, I think it's safe to say it on this show, anybody listening is probably in total agreement with me anyway. Before I met the kids, I read their IEP statements, which are the, in case anybody's wondering, the statements that talk about the kid's disability, I guess. Supposed disability.
Yeah, it's the plan for defining and handling the child's disability, and it's created by the school, the teachers, the psychologists, so on.
Right. It's created, in this case, it was created by these behavioral specialists, and I found out that what they're doing, they were doing these quantitative tests on them. How they were doing this, I don't know, but you know, on this scale, on that scale, and every single scale, you would read these IEPs and say, I don't even believe this. But when I finally met the kids and talked to the parents and the kids, I heard a completely different story. I kept wondering, why are there real stories left out of the IEP in all cases? Mm-hmm. Trauma, and the trauma was a school trauma. It was from bullying at school, and the parents and the kids all said it all started with the bullying. Of course, this is completely ignored by these behavior specialists, and they told me very specifically, "Oh, we don't even deal with that." I was furious, and I said, and also there was something, one of the students said something going on at home that I was very concerned about, and I can't say what it was because they claim it's HIPAA, but obviously it wasn't even HIPAA. I'll get to that in a minute, but basically there was something going on that the mother was concerned about. And she and I came to an agreement about it, and then the kids at school said, oh, you can't talk to her anymore. So I started really worrying, because I knew it was part of my job to talk to the parents. And then I found out, they said, well, what we really need you for is to make sure the kids get to class, because this is too funny, it's laughable, because if the kids don't show up, they could be out robbing a bank. out robbing a bank. 13-year-old kid robbing a bank. And they said, and then the school is responsible. Oh, no, we'll be sued. So you have to make sure they're in class. So the real issue, the whole reason they were called disabled was because they were cutting class. Now, why are they cutting class? Because they hate school. Come on. And you can, and because they know how. They know it's very, very easy to cut class in cyber school. They know how. They can do it. And they could, they would do it whenever they could get away with it. They were all doing it. And so what happened? They got labeled, and then they got me, a policewoman. And I said, I refuse to be a policewoman. You hired me to be a support person, and now you're telling me I have to be a policewoman? And after I had already quit, they send me a reminder notice with my stuff from my contract in it, saying that if you say anything bad about the school, well, basically, this is grounds to be fired. I'm not even working there. Oh boy. So I really felt they can do nothing, and they told me to shred all my records. I said, well, you can't shred my memory. You can't shred who I am. And I was just laughing my fool head off over that. It was actually an extremely traumatic experience, something that I've had to recover from. It was very upsetting, you know, just seeing these kids put on disability and you know, basically so they can put them on Medicaid, so they can milk the Medicaid. That's the main reason. The school was milking the Medicaid and using the kids and wrecking their lives to do it.
Well, that's another tragic example of how these diagnoses and so-called treatments are misused to, you know, again, put the onus of any problem inside the kid's brain. I just wanted to jump in there, Peter, because I've been to many of those IEPs with the kids that I saw, and it was always the same, Julie. I would go in there, and there would be kind of this united front about why the kid needed to be medicated, but it left out all of the context of the bullying at school, or the violence in the kid's neighborhood, or the, you know, the domestic violence at home. So I think it's so challenging when you have, you know, school officials, teachers. Some of them are very honorable, loving, career people who are overwhelmed too, and just saying, you know, you got to do something. You know, how can we get this classroom of 40 kids to not be giving the teacher a nervous breakdown? But
yeah,
I wanted to say something real.
I was paid for by Medicaid, and I did nothing medical. Absolutely nothing medical. I think I could go to Medicaid and tell them, you know, they shouldn't be, you don't want to be paying for a policewoman. You should get, you know, a real cop in there if you really want that. And basically, these cyber schools, they're supposed to be used for really, when a cyber school is really effective is when it's used as just a helping thing for homeschooling. Then it can be helpful, you know, just to use as a framework for parents to teach their kids. It's not really supposed to be meant for kids to do on their own. And, you know, I couldn't be that person that virtually sat with the kid. It wasn't working. And it
Julie,
wasn't working.
Explain a little more to people the term cyber school and what falls into that category.
Oh, basically, well, my first experience with it was as a student, and I was completely disgusted. There's no classroom. What they do, and they did it a little differently when I took some college classes online, it was different. Actually, when I did it, you watched YouTubes, and it was $1,000 a credit. I was so disgusted, I quit. But and they wouldn't let me quit. They start to threaten me. But that was my experience. And they use something called Blackboard, which is a multifunctional piece of software. And people hate it, but it makes classrooms. Sometimes they're done by video, but usually it's like you put up a PowerPoint and you run through the PowerPoint. for this particular school, they had a preset curriculum, and all the teachers had to do was run through the slides. They weren't really, I don't really call that teaching, but I guess am I old-fashioned? Is this what school has turned into? I don't know. But
so this is an online school that substitutes for the going to school for kids who don't go to school?
Exactly. Now, I think the only time online school is ever going to work or be okay is when, as I said, the parents who are homeschooling their kids, for any reason whatsoever, you know, they can use the curriculum from the cyber school, and you know, they do have to be enrolled, but then I think it could work, anything else, you know. Having kids chat with each other via text messaging. That's what they had to do in school, via text messaging, basically, the whole school. The teacher would actually speak and occasionally call on the kids, rather rarely. And again, they were just going through slides on a PowerPoint, basically. And everything was dumbed down very badly, I mean, to the point where I think maybe not all the kids, but some of the kids were just very, very bored. And
wow, Peter.
What, Michael?
Peter, I'm just going to say, you know, this whole Brave New World thing with electrodes on your head at night, and then the powers of the bee can even reach out to kids in the cyber school and figure out that they have a disability and they should be labeled and medicated. I mean, the whole thing is just like this Orwellian dystopia.
It is so Orwellian that it was never written about as science fiction, because there were no science fiction books in which all the children in society were drugged, for example, or large numbers of them were drugged. I mean, that kind of thing, and now this, you know, putting these electrodes on their heads to stimulate the brain. It's not stimulating the brain, by the way. What it's doing is it's electrically traumatizing the brain. It's not you can't go in and stimulate the brain. You electrically traumatize it. If you do it enough, you hurt brain, you harm brain tissue. And if you do it a little, you cause functional disorders that you may not quite recognize as having a physical component. But it's all about disabling brain function when you introduce something foreign into the brain, and especially something electrical, because the brain communicating system is electrical in nature, and so you're disrupting the natural goings-on in the brain.
Can I just say something real quick about one of the culprits, Peter, that I bet you...
Yeah, let me say thank you to Julie.
Oh, okay.
Thank you
for
calling in. And, yeah, Michael, pick up... yes.
Well, we haven't talked about NAMI yet, NAMI, but I'll bet NAMI is fully supportive of this whole thing. And just in the last second here, let me say, you and I remember in the 1990s when NAMI did this huge initiative change from just focusing on so-called severely and persistently mentally ill adults, and said, no, let's go out and spread our whole message and our power into schools and children and teen services. And so I saw that again on the ground, at ground zero there in the county system where I worked, where NAMI came and just said, you know, we have this new initiative. We're bringing the same vision of severe mental illness into affecting how kids are served. And it wasn't long till in the waiting room of the child and adolescent clinic I was at, there were these slick brochures from NAMI that said, you know, this brochure was funded by Pfizer, right? And they were there, brought in to the waiting room of our children's clinic, saying that only a child psychiatrist can evaluate your child. And, you know, here's a clinic full of therapists and psychologists, right? So NAMI, I think, has always been part of the triple unholy alliance of psychiatry, pharma, and as you know, NAMI has got power that moves all this stuff a lot.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. I don't know. I haven't heard in a long time much about Chad, which was the child version of NAMI, and had to accompany funding. I don't know if those functions have been absorbed into NAMI or whether Chad still exists. I'll have to try to find out more about that. So let's take a deep breath. We've got just a few minutes left. I mean, it seems to me that this farce, this fraud, this assault on children is going to get huge support. Yeah. And it will take one more step to destroying childhood, destroying children's concept of each other and of themselves, because other kids will learn from the kids that they're taking this thing at night, doing this at night. And what is this going to mean? This is so Brave New World. It's beyond Brave New World, because as I say, in Brave New World, there was nothing like this being done to children. It's gonna be tough, but the world. Let me pull myself out of the doldrums that receiving this email of information from Michael Cornwall, who is my guest today. I don't think I've repeated your name, Michael Cornwall. Michael, do you want to give anything out about getting in touch with you?
My website is michaelcornwall.com, so people can contact me there.
Michaelcornwall.com.
Michael
did a very fine issue, by the way, on alternative states, and invited me to participate and do an article, and that was from the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, and you're the editor or co-editor, Michael?
I'm the editor of that, and actually there's going to be a second volume with 20 more authors addressing the question of extreme states and how to compassionately respond that you did with your great article.
And people can purchase the first one, the volume?
The first one is up online if they go to Journal of Humanistic Psychology, and print copy is going to be out in the next couple of months.
And can they read it? Do they have to pay $30 or something?
If they contact me, I can get them a copy free if they contact me through the website. And when the print copy comes out, it won't be as expensive as getting articles online. Yeah.
All right. So I will be having Michael back time and again over the coming years, months and years. I deeply appreciate you, Michael, and what you do. And we have been friends for a long time in this movement. And I'm really glad you're there.
I'm glad you're there.
Okay, and my audience, I'm glad you're there. I had to let off some steam in a meaningful way today. Thank you. Thank you.